This is Hearts of Oak podcast. Free speech, religious disagreement, children's rights, and open and free discussion on any topic are bedrock to a democratic free society, and we seek to promote and champion these basic rights. Join us. Let's keep the conversation going.
It's wonderful to have Jared Batten back for the second time with his sleek new look. Thank you, Jared, for joining us.
That's all right. Thanks for having me, and thank you to all the people sending my messages in, most of them positive so far.
I'll look out for the negative ones. Don't worry, Jared. I'll bring any up. Obviously, Jared, today is the Remembrance Day, and most of our viewers will be UK, but some may be abroad. But on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, we remember those who have fallen for the country. So I don't know if you want to jump in there. Actually, it was a year ago we were at the Cenotaph filming.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, what can you say? I mean, you know, the people sacrificed their life and limb over centuries in order to defend the independence of this country. And now we're busy dismantling everything, dismantling our history. Or we're not, but the people in control of things are. Dismantling our history, dismantling our traditions, unpersoning historical characters, tearing down their statues. I watched today, before I came on here, a talk by David Starkey, who's now got his had to get his own YouTube channel because he's now been unpersoned from Cambridge University. Yeah. And Lineker College has just changed its name to some Vietnamese billionaire lady's name who's given them a big donation and apparently made billions by launching an airline where the air hostesses wore bikinis. And I never knew anything about Thomas Lineker, but David Starkey did a talk on it explaining how he was a doctor and a scholar from the end of the 15th, early 16th century, worked for Henry VIII and was a very influential figure at the time, very widely respected, but he no longer matters, so they've changed. He wasn't even a slaver, you know, he didn't even commit the cardinal sin of owning any slaves because they didn't have slavery then. But he's been unpersoned and the name is being changed in the college. So, and of course, those people who fought and died fought to keep our independence, our national freedom and democracy, and the government and the people in charge of all the institutions are now busy dismantling all that. So very sad to remember those people's sacrifices in the light of what's happening now.
Not completely. When you think of what they gave and that sacrifice, that patriotism, that service, and yeah, you wonder whether anyone would do anything unless they have so many likes on whatever social media platform you're on. So yeah.
Well, I mean, you look at the last spate of wars that we've had. I mean, in Afghanistan and Iraq, and what's it been about? It's in retrospect, looking back, it was about making the American military-industrial complex very, very rich, and people like Blair and George Bush Jr. very, very rich, just to name a couple out of them. And
not completely.
Why would anybody join the army now and want to risk their life and limb? I couldn't think of a possible good reason for doing that now.
Yep, for what exactly? Well, that's obviously around the world, people have different moments where they remember those in their military who have given the ultimate, their lives of sacrifice. So that was today in the UK at 11 o'clock. But moving on, Joe, we talked about what people fought for. And one thing is actually for the right to live your lives without government control or coercion, or free from a totalitarian regime. And talking about freedom, you're on Getter. If anyone's not on Getter, having Jared on is a very good reason to get on Getter, GETTR, that you can get on. If you're on it and are not following Jared, then there is the handle at GJB2021. You can find Jared and have his wisdom every few hours and not just every few weeks on Hearts of Oak. So, Jared, you're on Getter and you're obviously on Twitter. You took yourself off that, and other platforms have been a bit not as smooth, and I find Getter quite smooth and it seems to do what it says on the tin.
Well, yes, I was on Twitter, and I built it up to 74,900 to be precise, but then they kicked Trump off And I lost about 4,000 followers over a weekend. And I thought, no, there's no point in being on here. I'm going to say something they don't like. I'd already been cut off for a week, I think twice, I think, if I remember, for talking about the virus. So it was only a question of time. So I thought, well, I'm not hanging around to be cancelled. And I was spending far too much time on it anyway. But I did enjoy replying to the more negative comments sometimes. But anyway, I'm off now. But I just gave it a rest, and now I'm on Getter. And in the space of a week, I'm up to 747, last time I checked, followers. I'm immensely grateful to anybody that bothers to follow me on there. And, you know, there's been some interesting stories which I've been able to share which have come up. And there'll be a lot more in the insane world we currently live in. So I'm hoping it takes off big time like Twitter did. And also, I think one of the most cheering bits of news we've had recently is that Donald Trump intends to launch his own media platform. Now, if he does something like YouTube, I think it will take off, even if he does something like Getter. And incidentally, I think that Getter was actually launched by somebody who worked for Trump. So who knows if we don't see it merged with Trump's platform. But if Trump does something like YouTube, I think he'll take off like a rocket.
No, completely. And yeah, you're right. Jason Miller is the CEO of Getter, and he was Trump's media advisor. One of actually the probably smaller number of people who actually went a full term with Trump. So Jason Miller is quite an individual to be able to take on everything that happened during that presidential term. And Getter also have this event on the 8th of December. We'll be putting out, well, not that they don't have the event. They're sponsoring the event, which is a free speech event. And I saw Loza was promoting that and others. And we'll put out the details on different social media. So if you're on Getter and following at Hearts of Oak, we'll put that out. And we'll put out on all the other, whether that's on probably Getter and Gab and Telegram are the three ones that we use more than anything else. But get on, follow us, follow Jared on Getter, and we'll put out information on that free speech event, which quite interesting. The first time that we've had probably since back at the beginning of the, I'll call it a pandemic. I'll not call it anything else because we're on YouTube.
Yeah, that's exactly why we need something where we can speak the plain truth, isn't it?
I keep putting plan in before, and that doesn't work. And then I put scam.
It's even worse.
Anyway, yeah, we will look after our speech tonight. Jared, just before we go into, and the topic is English Channel immigration, Armada overwhelms the Kent Coast, and we've seen the numbers regularly. But you were UKIP immigration spokesman for some years before you were leader of the party. So what was that role like as immigration spokesman?
Well, I did an enormous amount of work on it, analysing it. And in actual fact, I produced this booklet. And I think this is about 2009, 2010. Immigration, action overdue. My God, if it was true 10 years ago, it's certainly true now. Yep. I'll refer to it a bit as we go through our talk. But being a spokesman on anything was UKIP. Was interesting because Nigel was leader at that time and he didn't actually want any spokesman, but the press officer at that point, I won't name him, I won't say who he was, but he got fed up with the press asking him who was the spokesman on this subject or that subject, so he appointed the spokesman. Wow. And of course I took it very conscientiously. I was the defence and security spokesman for a few years. Then I moved on to immigration, and I produced an enormous amount of work finding out what the actual situations were, facts and figures, how we fix it, suggesting policies, and then Nigel would go on the TV and or the radio and make a policy up off the top of his head without any reference to what anybody else had done. So that's the way UKIP operated, I'm afraid.
It managed to achieve more than any other party has in 100 years. So
I know. Well, just think what it would have been like if we'd have been organised.
I know. So, Jared, let's jump in. And we're looking at the immigration. And I just came across this little meme, which I thought would put it up. I think we've had a few smiles already, but I put it up that's where England and France have been about dominating the world, and now they're fighting over who owns a fish. And I think that's where we've got to at the moment. But Jared, there, if I could just touch on some of the numbers that we've seen coming over the channel and going back to, let me look, 2018, there were 540 refugees, immigrants. Well, let's call them individuals who came over because we don't know whether they were fleeing from anything apart from France. So there were 540 in 2018. Then we scroll, we rush forward to 2019. And in 2019, there were, I think, around 1,800 in 2019. So it's gone up three times. Then 2020, it's up to 8,500. So you're up four times there. And at the moment, 2021, I have seen different figures. It takes a while for the figures to come through. But I know looking a month ago, an official figure was around 17,000 or maybe 18,000. And probably every couple of weeks, we hear about a new record being broken. And last month, there were 859, which was the most ever on a single day. And I saw a tweet from a BBC journalist, Simon Jones, who puts this stuff up fairly often. And I think it was yesterday, or it could have been Tuesday, there were 690 migrants on 22 boats reaching the UK. And the French authorities intercepted, that's really nice of them, or rescued 255 people. The BBC are probably being too gracious to the French. But so it's gone up in 4 years from a couple of hundred to approaching 20,000. And I don't know what your, I mean, we'll probably widen it a little bit, talk about immigration in general, but on that little stretch of water coming over, boats coming over, it seems as though it is getting to the point where it's out of control and literally overwhelming those communities on the Kent coast.
Well, I mean, in your headline, I think you said that this was an armada, didn't you?
Yeah.
Well, in days gone by, we used to repel armadas. Now we invite them over. One of the mystifying things about this is why the UK Border Force is actually bringing these people over. The government, we now have a government-sponsored cross-channel ferry service for illegal migrants. Now, the government are to blame. The Border Force, I believe, now refusing to implement the law because they're frightened that if they turn boats back and people drown, that they will be accused of manslaughter or murder or something. And, of course, it would be very politically incorrect to actually enforce the law in this instance, because what the law says is, of course, a migrant should, a refugee, if that's what they are, and we all know they're not, they're all economic migrants. And we can come on to reasons for that later maybe, but they're supposed to seek asylum in the first designated safe country that they come to, and there is a whole list of designated safe countries agreed by the UN. And, of course, there are lots of them in between where they're coming from and the Kent coast.
Yeah.
So they are not abiding by international agreements, which is that they seek asylum in the first safe country that they come to. Mm-hmm. The countries don't want them, so they're ferrying them on. I believe they're even given free rail tickets or whatever in certain countries to move on to the next place. Of course, they all end up in France. And for France, the French authorities are facilitating this movement across the channel. So our supposed allies and, you know, our partners, as we're always supposed to call them, are actually taking action against our national interests and our sovereignty and our borders. So you could argue that this is an act of an aggression and is a kind of undeclared warfare on part of the French to facilitate people to invade us over our borders. They don't want to deal with the problem. They should be trying to deal with the problem on their borders. Instead of that, they're bringing the problem to the coast and then helping them across. Our border force should actually be returning these people. Now, I know you'd get into an international incident, but that's inevitable because, you know, when people don't abide by the law, then, of course, you're bound to get into a very difficult situation. The French are not doing that. I can't see why the border force can't pick these people up take them to a French beach, destroy the boats, give them a warm drink and a blanket, and send them up the beach to go back to France. That's what we ought to be doing, because we'd never do that, because then we would be invading French territory. But of course, they're allowed to send people over to invade ours. So there's no backbone or guts or determination in the British government anymore to actually do anything. And I have a tiny bit of sympathy for Priti Patel, because if the border force won't do what they're supposed to do, what the hell do you do? You can't really go on television and say, well, I'm powerless because my own troops won't do what they're supposed to do in the face of the enemy. So what does she do? I don't know. I think it's like we're up shit creek, I'm sorry, in this instance, as we are in so many others in our national life. But okay. I think there should be some measures that we can take against the French. Government should be sitting down and saying, if the French are going to do this to us, then what could we do to the French interests in our country that might actually make them think again? France has sorry.
No, no, just, when you're touching the border force, I was looking through before this and trying to see what we have. And obviously we're an island nation, but the border force have 9 ships, but some of them we've bought from other navies after they finished with them. So they're not necessarily the latest, fastest vessels, but actually some of them are just cast-offs from others that basically before they sink them, they sell them off to the Brits. So we have some of these ships that really aren't really fit for purpose. And it was a headline in the Kent Online, that fantastic journal. And let me just bring up the story because it's interesting. Oh, no, it's not going to. So the headline is £703 million plan to replace border force boats to tackle illegal immigration. That was 24th of October. But it seems as though, I mean, we've always been an island. It's not as if after Brexit we became an island. So it's quite confusing why the government haven't worked out how to look after us all up to now. And only in the last month have they decided, oh, our boats are quite old, we maybe need to spend more money fixing them instead of adding some on here and there. And actually I read another crazy thing that 2 of the boats, they were busy patrolling the seas around Greece. And yeah. Patel said, oh, we should bring them back. What the hell are they doing in Greece? We don't care about Greece. We care about those coming into the UK. So the whole thing just seems farcical.
Well, I mean, 703 million quid. You think what you could do with 703 million pounds to help the homeless sleeping on our streets? But of course, who cares about them? They're just British citizens. And if they're a man aged between 18 and 65, all they're entitled to is to find their own cardboard box and sleep on the street. That's all they're entitled to. But we can find this kind of money to deal with a problem. Now, there is a problem, so it needs to be dealt with. But like you said, why couldn't they come up with a plan? Well, I did come up with a plan when I was the immigration spokesman. I got a 20-point plan in here that says how you would deal with immigration. And, of course, when Brexit came along, how would you deal with that? Well, we laid it all out. I wrote a EU exit plan for UKIP back in 2017. I mean, I don't suppose many people read it apart from our own members and voters who might have taken the trouble. But in it, you have a problem, you lay out what the problem is, and then you lay out the practical solutions to it. And we could have done it. But as you say, here we are, all of these years on, and nothing has been done about it. And it ought to be possible for us above anybody else to control immigration. If you want to get to the UK, there's 3 ways of doing it. You come in through a port, you come in through an airport, or you come in illegally across the channel, which, although it's only 20 miles wide at certain stretches, it's a very dangerous channel because it's very busy and it has tides and whatever that can make it dangerous for small boats. So if anybody could control it, we should be able to. And yet our government in all of these years, in over 10, 15 years, has never been able to do anything about it and doesn't seem to have the will to do anything about it. I mean, I don't believe that Priti Patel really, I mean, it's all show, it's all words, it's all, you know, it's about how many of the voters can you fool in order to get them to vote for you next time. It isn't actually about doing anything about anything anymore. It hasn't been for a long time.
They also make a call for one of the MPs.
Your sound has gone, Peter.
Is my sound gone?
Yeah, that's better. Yeah.
I came across one of the MPs, one of the Conservative MPs, who has just submitted a form to say that he works, I think it's 60 hours. It could be 60 hours a week or 60 hours a month of work outside parliamentary business. And you realize, actually, these people are maybe so busy doing other jobs that they don't have time to actually run the country.
Well, do you imagine that they actually read all the legislation that comes before them? I mean, I don't watch Parliament on TV. And in fact, we're not there now. I think they're too frightened of catching COVID. But, you know, you'd have an important debate and you'd have a few people sitting in the chamber. Probably Dennis Skinner, because he's retired now, isn't he? But he was always there. I would have a law that says, or it'd be terms of becoming an MP, that once you become an MP, you are paid a good salary. I'd pay them a good salary, 100,000 quid or whatever. You know, their travelling expenses and all the rest of it. But the part of the rules would be you cannot have outside employment. Because if you don't know how the world operates by the time you become an MP, then you've got no business being there. They say, oh, they have to have these outside interests to keep in touch with the outside world. Mm-hmm. No, that's what you're a constituency MP. You will have business people, ordinary people, professional bodies coming to you to tell you what's what. If you don't know how things work, they'll soon tell you in that whatever area of life that you've not been involved in. But by the time you get there, you should be knowledgeable about the way the world works or able to absorb information about things that you weren't aware of before. You don't need to work outside. Yep. You should be paid a good salary, and that's it. You concentrate on what you're supposed to be doing. And don't forget, the job of MP now has been downgraded quite a lot to glorified social worker. Mm-hmm. The days when MPs used to sit in the chamber and worry about affairs of state and legislation, that's now been downgraded, and they care about, you know, their constituents' gas bills and whatever. And well, that's what they do. I mean, this is because so much power was taken away from local councillors under Mrs. Thatcher's regime that they're fairly powerless. They're just there to rubber stamp whatever the council passes through the body at the top of the tree. And a lot of that day-to-day stuff has now fallen on the shoulders of MPs. Well, let them get on with that. Let them do that, but let them also study, read and understand the legislation that they're passing and vote on it accordingly. Most of them go through the lobby, I'm sure, voting the way that they've been told to vote, with probably fairly minimal knowledge of the legislation that's passing through and what they're voting on. Now, we had this in the European Parliament, and again, for a number of years, I think it was the only job that Nigel ever appointed me to, but he asked me to be the chief whip. And part of that job was actually sitting down every day in Strasbourg when we had votes with the assistants from the different committees who supported MPs and working through every single vote. Mm-hmm. What did it mean? What were the implications of it? How did it fit in with UKIP strategy, policy, etc.? And, of course, we didn't vote for anything because we didn't accept the legitimacy of the European Union to vote, legislate over the British people, but we still had to understand it. And it was very intensive, but I quite enjoyed that because I knew what was actually happening, because there are about 20 committees in the European Parliament sending this stuff through every month. Other parties there, I know, actually didn't do that. They didn't vote on how, and after this, by the way, we had a vote of the MEPs that they all agreed that we were voting the same way. So it was quite an intensive day. Mm. 4 days of the week in Strasbourg in the week that we were there. But most parties actually just went down there. They got their voting list from the group that they were in, not even their own political party, Tory or Labour, and they voted according to where the group had already decided to vote. Well, I don't think that's the job of a legislator. I think the legislator should actually know what is going on and vote in accordance with their conscience, but also with what they believe that the basis on which they were elected. I don't think that happens in our parliament. Otherwise, you wouldn't get the stuff that's coming through. What was the last big thing that they voted on? It was to do with the coronavirus, the extension of the Coronavirus Act, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So if that doesn't prove that they're totally out of touch with the country, I don't know what does.
No, and when you look at when you expect some pushback from the Tories, they all vote with the government with a heavy heart. I mean, screw the heavy heart. What about the country and the damage you're causing? But they don't care.
No.
It's about, you're right, it's about following the way, whichever lobby they're supposed to go through, they'll walk through. So, yeah.
Yeah. So in short, I think Singapore used to do this. I mean, I might be wrong about this. Somebody will correct me. But I thought when Lee Kuan Yew was running it, and maybe after him, every member of the Singapore government got paid about $1 million Singaporean dollars every year. But part of the deal was that you don't have any outside employment or direct business interests. And that's the way it should work here. Pay them a decent salary. It is a very, very, if you do it properly, it's a very, very responsible job. You're deciding how all of your fellow citizens are going to live based on the legislation that you pass. So that should be your primary concern.
But then Theresa May couldn't earn $1.1 million after dinner speaking, and Jeffrey Cox couldn't earn his $400,000. That's very selfish, Gerard.
Well, I think what I wouldn't exclude from that is what I wouldn't include in it. I think if people write articles or books or maybe give speeches, so long as that is part of their remit of what they're talking about. You know, I've written books on different subjects to do with what I was dealing with, and I never made any money out of it. They weren't bestsellers. But I wouldn't have any objection to people doing that. Mm. But I think actually working for somebody in a commercial enterprise should be a no-no. You shouldn't be allowed to do that.
Jared, one other thing, and then we'll talk about in general some of the figures, but I think we were talking before about the cost of coming over. It's not a freebie to actually travel from wherever all the way to the UK, and the whole thing of people smuggling and the thousands of pounds. So the people we get aren't necessarily those who are destitute, but they're possibly people who have a bob or two.
Well, yes. I mean, you did some research on this, and you give me this figure of it's costing them, the refugees, in inverted commas, between £3,000 and £6,000 to pay the people smugglers to bring them over. Well, where are they getting £3,000 to £6,000? The people smugglers may well be running some kind of racket where these people are doing slave labour once they get over. We know that there was a lot of prostitution as a result of EU opening up the borders in the EU. People were being brought over, or women were being brought over and forced to do this in order to pay off their debts to the people smugglers. People coming from Africa, where the hell are they getting £3,000 to £6,000 if they're so poverty-stricken, which I'm sure they are? I think that it's been shown that a lot of this money is donated and paid for by organisations, and dare I say, even such people as George Soros are actually involved in helping migrants come across the Mediterranean and get all the way to England. So then this money has got to be paid somehow. I mean, and people smuggling is supposed to be a very serious crime. So, okay, why isn't something being done about the people smugglers? Why aren't the British authorities asking the French authorities to cooperate with them in order to arrest these people on the French side and give them very, very severe sentences? I mean, I'd be quite happy to hang them personally, but I don't think that's ever going to happen, because if you are smuggling people and you're trading in people, then that's a very, very serious offence, especially if you're bringing them over then to take part in illegal activities, like all of the Eastern European begging gangs that you see on the streets. You know, people pathetically coming up and asking you for money, and you know very well that they're going to go back to their gang master or whatever they're called, hand the money over and start doing it again. And that's all throughout you. You see that in every European capital. I mean, the days when we could travel, you know, nobody can travel much anymore, but you used to see it wherever you went. Yeah, why isn't something being done about these people? And that would take, as I say, we know that in, where was it, Sangat and places like that, these people were roaming about, plying their trade, coming from the UK, organising the next lot of people to come over. These people, instead of worrying about make-believe white supremacist terrorists that don't exist, how about worrying about the real gangsters and the real criminals that are doing all this and stamping down on them? You know, if we had a police force that wasn't politically correct, perhaps they'd be thinking, or a security services who actually knew their job, they'd be trying to do something about it.
Yeah, yeah. Jared, let's look at the figures. You had sent me over figures that you come across from Migration Watch, who have done a fantastic job on this issue for many years. And if I can, I was just going to bring up one of the charts you sent over, which shows the overall changes from 1975, yeah, all the way up to 2020. And I think the graph speaks for itself. As you can see, an increase, actually probably around zero net migration up until probably the mid or late 90s.
Right. Well, interestingly, when I looked at that, and it's quite interesting as a graph, and of course this only shows the net figure. Bear that in mind. And the net figure is much less than less than the gross figure.
Yeah.
So you have, you know, in a bad year, you can have over 600,000 people coming in gross, 300,000 leaving, and you still can have well over 300,000 staying. So just on the net figures, what I thought I would do would be to break it down from 1975 till 2020 and see how it fared under each government. Now, the total figure for net, and these are Migration Watch's figures, so I can't, I guess that they're reliable because that's Nation Immigration Watch will go through the government's figures, you know, the Office for National Statistics or whatever. The total net in that period of time was 5,491,000, according to these figures. So 5.5 million net. That means the gross figure must have been at least 10 million. And possibly anything up to 15 million. And, of course, people were coming in. Who are they coming in? Well, they're coming in from all around the world. And who's leaving? Well, it might be people who came here, decided they didn't want to stay, but also quite a lot of British people decided that they've had enough and have left and gone to countries like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, America, if they could, in the days when you could still travel. So let's break it down a little bit, shall we? 1975 to 1979, that was a Labour government. And quite astoundingly, I found that there was a net figure of minus 68,000. So 68,000 people, there was a decrease by 68,000 because, you know, more people left than actually came in by a degree of 68,000. Okay, the Tories took over in 1979. The figures actually, for the first 3 years, you had net losses, but then it started to ramp up. So by the time that Labour came in 1998, you had under the Tories, you had 446,000, according to these figures, of a net gain of population. And then, of course, Blair came in 1998. And between 1998 and 2010, it was an election in 2010, wasn't there? You had Blair and then you had Brown briefly. Well, the net gain then in people through immigration was 2,664,000. Wow. And then we come on to the bit that doesn't surprise me at all. From 2010 until the current day, which is or it's 2020 anyway, 10 years for which we have figures, the Conservatives have a net gain of 2,469,000. So there's not much difference between, but by the time you add in 2021, it will have gone up to the same as Labour did, 2.6 million. So there is, as I've been saying for years to anyone that will listen, there is no difference between Labour and Tories. They both want mass uncontrolled immigration. So in that period of time, as I say, 5.5 million. And if you looked at the gross figure, you're probably at least up to 10 million. Now, this is where, if I say a bit about, can I say a bit about immigration in general? I mean, this is what I went through in this little booklet, which is no longer available, of course. But Britain was never a country of mass immigration. People go, oh, it's always happened in the Roman time. No. I mean, you can't count, for example, if you're talking about immigration, the incursions of the Romans and the Vikings and the Normans and the Saxons wasn't immigration. It was invasion and settlement. And even then, for example, in Anglo-Saxon times, they don't know how many people came in as a proportion of the population. They imposed themselves on the existing population. And, of course, when the Normans invaded, they had about 10,000 troops. Well, even if you doubled that with reinforcements through the years, you know, you're talking tens of thousands of people in a population of 3 million, 4 million maybe. And, of course, during that whole period from the Norman invasion right up until the Second World War, you had some immigration. You had the Huguenots. You had some Irish in the 19th century. And then the Jews escaping pogroms in the late 19th, early 20th. But these were always a tiny percentage of the existing population. It was only after the Second World War that you really had mass immigration. And even then, the numbers after the Second War, which I'm going from memory now, I think it may have been a couple of 100,000, which is very, very small compared to what we experience on an annual basis now. It really took off in the 1960s and 70s. And there's this myth that we're a country of immigration. No, we always had immigration in the past where people... where it was a small percentage of population, but also it was people who were coming in order to integrate. For example, when the Huguenots came over, they were Protestants who were persecuted in France, and so they wanted to come to a Protestant country, which Britain then was. It was the prevailing religion. So it was people who wanted to integrate and be absorbed, and they did. Same with the Irish migrants, of which there was a lot. They were coming from a Catholic country to a Christian country, so there wasn't a big problem. What the immigration that we've seen in recent years is completely, well, apart from being effectively mass and uncontrolled, because it isn't, if you're getting 600,000 people able to turn up every year, it's not really controlled, is it? One of the interesting things, one of the first things I did when I became an MEP was say, well, let's have a look at density of population.
Yeah.
And I had a spreadsheet of all of the countries in the world with the numbers of people in them and the landmass, and even the UK then was about 23rd. There's about 190 odd countries in the world, I believe. If you take out small anomalies like Malta or the Vatican City, then we were about 23 out of the world total in terms of density of population. If you look at England, because most people come to England, most people in the UK live in a line below Manchester. Yeah. You can draw a line through the middle of the country, and most people live in the south of England. They don't live in Scotland. They don't live in, well, you know, Northern Ireland, where you come from. You know, these are fairly small populations, and there's still lots of open space. And England is one of the most densely populated countries in the world. We were more densely populated than China, Japan, and India in terms of people per square mile. So why do we need mass immigration? Well, we never did. We were not like America in the 19th century, where you had vast amounts of open territory waiting to have its natural resources exploited. So America in the 19th century had a policy of mass immigration. We never needed that. And especially now, since the last 50 years, we're a post-industrial country. Yeah. We're not the workshop of the world anymore. We're still actually way ahead in many industries, especially ones requiring a high degree of research and technical innovation. We can still do it. Of course, we used to be able to do it fairly recently. I'm sure we still do it in many areas. We don't need vast amounts of unskilled labour, but they're being brought in. So why are they being brought in? Well, let's not beat about the bush. It is a deliberate policy, and it's not just going on here. It's going on around Europe. It's going on in the USA to destroy national identity, to destroy national loyalty, to put millions of people on the public payroll in terms of benefits and whatever, in order to make them vote a certain way. And that's, we've seen where that certain way leads. For example, in America now, where you've got Biden. People say it's communist. I don't think it is communist as such. It may have the outward trappings of communism, but really it's about rule by oligarchs and elites. We're getting to a bigger subject here, but we've seen this phenomenon, which is unique in history now, where power and money has been transferred from national borders or even from empires into big business and financial institutions which have no loyalty to any country, which sit above countries and can impose their will on countries. Our politicians and governments now are just puppets of these international financial institutions and power bodies like the International Monetary Fund, the Bank of International Settlements, the World Bank. These are the people that run the world now. And, of course, the World Economic Forum, our old favourite, which, of course, represents the top 1,000 corporations in the world. You have to have a turnover of $5 billion in order to be a member, and they make sure that governments do what is best for them, for their international corporate interests, not for ordinary people. That's why we're in the mess that we're in. And mass immigration is good for that. It's good because it brings in lots of cheap labour for these people where they need it. And it means that these people will, and you can understand why, will vote for socialistic Labourite type policies, which fit in with what the elite want to achieve. So that's why we're in the mess that we're in.
I was going to look ahead because there's a country that is dealing with the immigration in a certain way. Actually, before, could I, I see that we have about a third of you have clicked on that like. You may dislike Gerard. I don't know. There may be the odd dislike there. I'm wondering, no, we don't have any dislikes yet. Oh, well, I'm sure there's some troll that can dislike Gerard, but the rest of you do take a moment and click on that like button and you can share the love with Gerard. And then obviously we'll look at those later. And if you'd like Gerard on, then your thumbs up in a like will work on that and help him come on again. But let me jump. So
Poland, I think they like you too, Peter. You're a much nicer chap than I am. I'm sure they like you as well.
No, you're much sleeker than I am, Gerard. No, so, well,
no. You could do it too. Just check with your wife. It's okay.
No. Poland, Gerard, we're seeing the interesting event on the Polish border, Poland and Belarus. I was going to say Ukraine. That would annoy Luba. We'll not say that. With Belarus, and it seems as though that Russia is pushing people towards the EU. That's what it seems to be playing out. And the EU don't know what to do in this because they hate Poland. They want to criticize Poland, and they're really confused because they don't want to back Putin. But it's interesting how the polls, I think yesterday 40 people came over the border and the polls had put all across a message to say we found all 40 and we have returned them immediately back to Belarus. That's how you deal with it. And I don't know why we can't see that as a great example. If you've got a problem, you deal with the problem, sorted.
Well, yeah, I mean, if it was this country, they'd all be taken to a nice, comfy abode where they could be able to sue the government for not letting them in. And, of course, in America now, Biden wants to give illegal immigrants who are deported $475,000 in compensation. I mean, it's all madness. But to go on back to Poland, I mean, yeah, it's nice to see Putin undermining the EU. But I've always said it, so I'll say it again. Putin is a gangster in charge of a gangster regime. He's it's a criminal enterprise, the government of Russia. So although he's been saying some good things lately, he's a highly intelligent man. He was a head of a security. He was a higher ranking security officer in the KGB. And he's run some high level criminal organizations and he can control the Russian mafia. So he knows what he's doing. And but he's been saying some things about, you know, European culture and protecting it and all the rest. Well, okay, he knows what people want to hear. He's happy to undermine the EU. I have to say, I'm happy for the EU to be undermined, but because I think it's a thoroughly bad thing. It's destroying national democracy, national allegiances, national self-determination, and I think that's a very bad thing. But what they're doing in Russia, on the Polish border, of course, Belarus has been in trouble because. Is it Lukashenko, I think, that the president, if I remember his name, he wouldn't bow the knee to the COVID regulation that were being imposed on the world. He told, and he's not a pleasant character, let's not pretend he is, but he told the world powers that run the world where they could stick their virus and their vaccines. And, of course, that means that he has to be undermined. So he's getting his own back on the EU by helping these people come across the border into Poland, and the Poles are stuck in the middle. And, of course, they're not having it. I don't think they need to worry too much because the migrants won't stay in Poland because in Poland there's no benefits, there's no public housing. I don't think there's a national health service. I'm not sure about that, but they would probably have to pay for any treatment they want. So they will leg it as fast as possible across Europe to get to the Channel and invest in a dinghy. But let's hope the Poles manage to stop them coming over.
Maybe they should bring in conscription. So for a year, it's hard labor in the military or something.
Well, I mean, one of the things we should do, I want to say that a bit about why they're coming over, Peter. Mm. One of the things we should do is say, for these illegal immigrants, many of whom destroy their whatever paperwork they've got, so we don't know where they come from, you could say, well, we will deal with your complaint, But we will take you to an island where we will have a very comfortable encampment. You'll have nice wooden huts, warm blankets. You have a vegetable patch where you can grow your food. We own various we still have various dependencies around the world, you know, like St. Helena and what's the other little island that we have?
Ascension Island.
There's loads of these places in the Atlantic where we could take people across, put them on there and say, there you are, that's where you'll stay until we actually deal with your application. And chances are it'll be refused because you didn't go through the proper channels in the first place. So you can do a few years here while you wait for the courts to grind through this, and then you'll be sent back anyway. I think that that would quickly see an end to these people coming across the channel if they knew how they were going to be treated when they got there. And I'm not suggesting any mistreatment of anybody. I don't want to see that. But they cannot just take the mickey out of us, which they are doing, and expect to get away with it, which they do. And as you've pointed out, very, very few of them ever get sent back anyway. In terms of one point I'd like to make of overpopulation, when I said to you we're one of the most densely populated countries in the world, in England, the population of the UK, I think when Blair took over, was about 58 million. I think the population now is about 66 million. And I did there was an Optimum Population Group, I think they were called. And I have a graph in the book which shows UK population 1901, 2000, or projected up to 2081. And we are well on the way because we were supposed to be at about 70 million by 2021. Well, we're close on that. If it's 66 million and there are lots of illegals. And we are due to get up to about 85 million by 2000. I can't even see it. I need to put my glasses on. Sorry. But it's quite small print. 2081. So, and that will probably, and that's speeded up, that kind. I think that growth is speeding up. So we are going to be a vastly overpopulated country. Where are we going to put all these people? You can see everywhere when you travel around, certainly in London. I don't know what it's like in every other city. Your viewers will see it. High-rise flats going up everywhere. Where there used to be factories, where there used to be workshops, all been knocked down. Flats going up. You're going to have to build these all over the country, concrete over the green fields to accommodate these people. And what are they actually going to do in a post-industrial world?
Jared, you said about sending them to Ascension Island or St. Helena. To me, I mean, the Outer Hebrides, that's really what they should exist for. And no one wants to go to Scotland, do they?
Well, yeah, we're going to get lots of complaints now for any viewers in St. Helena and Ascension Island. And Philip, you know, I don't really want to upset those people because I'm sure they're very nice people who live a nice, quiet, sedate life. So excuse us. I think we need to find some fairly uninhabited islands. And, of course, if they went to Scotland, I mean, Scotland is one of the – what's the population in Scotland? 5 million, something like that, I think.
Yeah.
There's loads and loads of empty space in Scotland. You wouldn't have to send them right up to the Hebrides. And, you know, they are a socialist government, aren't they?
Yep.
Nicola Sturgeon's a great champion of the people. I'm sure she'd love to have all of these people up there living in Scotland. Scottish are very welcoming people, aren't they? So they'd love to have them. So I think we should send them where the available land space is to actually build houses for them, and where they can, I don't know what they would do up there, but they could find something for them to do just as well as we can down here.
Yep.
So why not? It's a brilliant idea.
Ireland,
of course, is a vastly underpopulated country. Our great ally, of course, Ireland. And, of course, Ireland, we have there's a special relationship with Ireland where Irish citizens get the same rights as British citizens, although we don't get the same rights as Irish. We can't vote in their elections, I don't think, or their referendum. Nope. They can vote in ours. Well, I think that's an anachronism. The government should say, if you want us to continue with this arrangement, then you have to take all of these new migrants because you have the space and we don't. And if you don't want to do that, well, and let's call it a day on the special arrangement, because it doesn't work, does it?
Exactly.
That's what, you know, if you need somebody radical in government, and quite frankly, I don't think anybody radical would ever get elected. I think we've become a kind of a nation of middle-class remainer tosspots for the most part. And yeah. I can't see anybody radical ever getting elected. And if they look like they were getting elected, the media would destroy them anyway.
Jared, kind of finishing off this kind of ebbs and flows with levels of immigration or has. I mean, we saw the influx into Germany. Look at actually, you've had Peter Beiser on from the AfD, and he said there were 3 or 4 points in German history where they've had an influx and then been quieter. The UK seems to have a special draw, and it seems to continue, even though we have that water barrier, you still have that huge pressure. And I'm guessing your thoughts are that this is just going to continue. And as our government doesn't address it, it just gets more exasperated, and our institutions, our health service or education or housing just becomes more and more overrun and unable to cope. And then it just collapses. I mean, I guess that's what happens with this continued pressure.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could see, I mean, the health service, I mean, I just happened to see a headline today on, I don't look at the TV anymore because I haven't got a license, but I saw this headline, I think it was on the phone, that headlines come in saying that the waiting lists are now as worse as ever. So many million people who've waited a year, 2 years for treatment, operations. Well, of course, what did you expect when you close the country down and you don't treat people and you can't get to the doctor and you can't get to the hospital? Well, what did you expect? Yeah, of course it was going to happen. And of course, bringing all these people in to overload the system is going to just make it worse. It can't make it better. You know, we're not going to build vast numbers of new schools and hospitals and everything else we need to accommodate them. If you want to, and this is one of the facts I uncovered when I was immigration spokesman. I don't know what the rule is now, but if you wanted to go to Australia or New Zealand, I think it was Australia, might be wrong, but they would work out what your share of the gross domestic product was. So if the country was worth so many billion, I mean, our gross domestic product now is up to about nearly 2 trillion, I think. Yeah. So they'd work out what it was per head. And if you weren't on their list of desired migrants, like you had some special skill, electrician, plumber, doctor, whatever they wanted, but you just wanted to go and live there and you didn't have something that they wanted, they say, right, you can come, but you have to invest 250,000 Australian dollars or whatever it was, New Zealand dollars, into the economy in order to pay a contribution for all the things that you've never contributed to.
Yeah.
Because don't forget everything. If you've been paying, I mean, I've been paying tax for 49 years. Other people have been paying for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. You've contributed to the gross domestic product and the infrastructure in the country. Somebody coming in and they say, oh, these migrants pay tax. Yeah, well, they may earn more than £12,500 a year and pay tax, but they've never contributed anything to the infrastructure that they enjoy, the roads, the railways, the schools, the hospitals, the fire service, the police service. So if they don't have a skill that we actually need, and this should be immigration policy, what are the skills that we really can't meet ourselves that we actually need to import people? And if they just want to come and live here, then you divide the gross domestic product by the number of people in the population. You owe us half a million quid, whatever it is. You have to invest that over here if you want to come. Invest it in cash. But is that ever count? Of course it's not, because you'd need sensible politicians to do something like that, wouldn't you?
We don't have any of those, trust me.
No, and look, I know time's getting on and we're nearly due to finish. All of these people are trying to leave countries like Africa and the Middle East and whatever. Why? A lot of it is because they are countries that have been impoverished. How have they been impoverished? It isn't because people have gone there and stolen all their stuff. It's because now they're reliant on these international financial institutions that gives, or doesn't give, it loans them money, and there are strings attached to that money so that they have to trade, for example, with the EU, which means very often their own farmers, their own small business, or whatever, go bust, because the governments that have agreed to these loans, who are probably getting brown envelopes as well for doing it, have to then go and trade with other countries, which impoverishes the general population. And then you can't blame those people for actually wanting to go and live somewhere else. I mean, who can blame them? They're trying to escape poverty. What we should really be doing on an international level is looking at how you can invest in those countries and you can get a return on your investment, but you can also help those people build up their countries. I mean, the Chinese now have for years now had a policy of basically colonialism through free money. And they've gone in, they've bribed the politicians, they've invested in the infrastructure in those countries and basically taken ownership of anything that's important, all the minerals and whatever. And you've seen this most recently in Afghanistan, where you were pointing out, Peter, that they are they're going to harvest the natural resources there, which are vital for what mineral was it? I can't remember now. It was
on for batteries. It's worth about $1 trillion. And I can remember.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, they're going to go in and they are going to exploit that for the new fourth industrial revolution that Klaus Charles tells us about. They need all this stuff. But the Chinese actually had a policy for doing this, and it won't particularly benefit the ordinary people in those countries. It always benefits the rulers and the people doing the investing. So these are not just national problems. We can try and protect our borders, which we should do, but we should also try and say, you know, why these people are being forced to flee these countries and why they haven't got a reasonable life and standard of living where they're coming from. You know, instead of hiding behind all this post-colonial crap, you know, that we went there and stole all this stuff, which was never true anyway.
Oh, completely. We'll finish on that, Gerard. A lot to pack in, a lot to cover, and it's actually, we haven't looked at immigration for a while. So thank you, as always, for coming along and sharing your insight.
And thank you for all the comments, which we haven't had time to, I've been trying to look at them, and we haven't had time to comment on them all, but thanks for sending them in.
There are a lot of comments. Yeah. I tried to scroll through them and realized I was just getting lost in them, so I thought I better not do that. Jared's on Getter, as we said at the beginning, so make sure and follow him, then you get his wisdom. Probably every few hours, every day. So
I'm not sure I'd describe it as wisdom, but comments anyway.
You can, so you don't have to wait a whole month or whatever for Jared to be back on. You can follow him on that. So if you're not on Getter, get on it. If you're on some of the other platforms, from my point of view as a consumer, I want as many platforms as possible and for them all to succeed. So, and if I want to be in all of them, so we are across, and if you don't know where we are at any time, just go and click on that Find Us tab and you'll see where we are, and we put our stuff everywhere. And some platforms will do better than others, some may not succeed, but you don't know, and we don't know which ones will work, which ones won't. So get on a couple of them. Maybe if you're on Gab, also get on Getter. If you're on Parler still, then get on Getter, get on Gab, use them all, play around with them, see what you think, see what you like, and be part of that. But if you want Gerard, you want to get on Getter. So
it's the easiest to use, quite frankly. I couldn't make Gab work, and I could never get back on Parler once they took it off air.
You're right. Getter seems to work. It's clean interface. It works every time. And that's what you don't want, all the grief and hassle of what Parler had. So Getter seems to work. So I agree, Jared. That seems one of the beauties of it. And live streaming is just around the corner. So we will add that onto our list of about 7 or 8 destinations whenever that goes live. So thank you to our viewers. Thank you for all your likes. I think it was about 80% of you or 90% of you liked it. So I hope the other 10% we can encourage you the next time you're on. What do we have coming? I sent out an email out today if you didn't get it because you didn't subscribe. So click on that Connect tab on the heartsofoak.org website, top right. Click that, stick in your email address, and you get an email a week, sometimes every 2 weeks, depending what's on, whether I get around to it. But I sent one out today giving you updates and what we've had previously and what we have coming up. And finally, on Saturday, Speaker's Corner Steve is back with us again. He was going to be with us at the beginning of the month, but went down with, no, it wasn't the COVID. I don't know what it was, the sniffles. So he's with us on Saturday, giving us his thoughts, his views, and his take on the week's news. So tune in for Speaker's Corner Steve. And I think on that, I'll wish your viewers or listeners wonderful rest of your evening, and look forward to having you with us on Saturday with Speaker's Corner, Steve. And remember, get on Getter. And remember, let's go, Brandon. So good night to you all.
Cheers.
If you like what we do, sign up to our mailing list. Donate, share, and subscribe to our many platforms at heartsofoak.org. Thank you for listening.